Story number one. In the late 1800s, a family of Jewish teachers were riding through the Long Island countryside on their way to Port Jefferson. Suddenly, when they reached Huntington, one of their horses dropped dead. To buy a new one was out of the question, so they decided to set up shop in that exact place where their horse died. They courted other Jewish families in the area for Shabbat services, holiday celebrations, and social gatherings, many of which were held in their living room, until one day they formed the Huntington Hebrew Congregation. And as fate would have it, the eventual permanent home of the Huntington Hebrew Congregation, also known as the Huntington Jewish Center, would stand where it does today, on the same hallowed grounds of those early teachers. Story number two. In the late 1800s, Jews started to move into the town of Huntington. After many intimate gatherings at their co-religionist homes, but no thoughts of forming an official community, they realized they needed to start making preparations to bury their dead. So, in good Jewish tradition, the first collective action they took was to buy land to establish a cemetery. However, according to New York State law, all parochial cemeteries needed to be incorporated by an established religious institution. So, for practical purposes, this group of Huntington Jews had to establish the Huntington Hebrew Congregation in order to build a Jewish cemetery. Coincidentally, because of a favorable land deal, this congregation would make its eventual permanent home on a piece of land near one of its original founding members. These are two stories about the origins of our community that were orally passed down to me by members of the congregation. But which is it? They can't both be right, right? Yes, they share some of the same facts, but those facts don't sound the same. Not to mention there are facts that are not the same. In one, there is a horse whose terrible fate birthed a community, and in the other, there is a cemetery that was vital to bringing a community together. Yet if you were to talk to each of the storytellers of these two versions of HJC's origin story, their story is absolutely right. Nothing can dissuade them from their truth, because when we share our stories, especially our origin stories, we share more than just our understanding of facts. We share how our souls make sense of the world. I want you to think about one of your origin stories. It could be how your family came to America, or how your parents met, or how you met your spouse. It could be when you developed your love for cooking, your passion for your favorite sports team, or your approach to politics. It could be about anything that matters in your life. And chances are that if something matters to you, then the story of how it came to matter to you is something very important to you. It is as if it becomes a part of your own soul, helping you make sense of your experience in the world. Scholars in the social sciences and religion have a term for these kinds of origin stories. They call them, of all words, myths. To paraphrase my teacher, the late JTS theologian Rabbi Neil Gilman, Zichrono Livracha, a myth should be understood as a structure that helps you organize and make sense of your experience. So for instance, one of my myths is that when I saw a beautiful sunset as I was taking the train into Huntington for my interview, was that I felt that God was calling me to serve here. That story, that myth, matters very much to me because it helps me make sense of why I'm here, to fulfill my call. That myth gives my experience at HJC a sense of powerful purpose. But I have a question. Does the very fact that a myth gives me or you or anyone else a sense of powerful purpose, does that make the myth true? Myths are designed for us to express our truth, but they often have a temperamental relationship with the, capital T, truth. This is why the term myth in popular parlance is erroneously synonymous with fiction. Gilman likes to describe how myths play with truth in fiction using the metaphor of a children's dot-to-dot book. And I quote, "Myths are the lines that connect the dots on the page so that we can see the bunny rabbit on the page. Except that now, the dots are not pre-numbered. We have to choose the dots, the facts that we want to connect, then assign the numbers, then draw the lines. Sometimes there are different connections to be made, each of which yields a different pattern. It is precisely because these connecting tissues are themselves invisible that myths are frequently viewed as fictions." Unquote. In other words, we connect the dots to choose the myths we need in order to make sense of our experience in the world, as individuals, as families, and as communities. And how we choose to read the connections between all of those dots is a reflection of our heart's yearning to be truthful to itself, to express itself in a way that is life-giving. As Torah teaches us, this is very close to your heart. I set before you life and death. Choose life. Myths are not fictions that wither and die. Myths are our truths that give our souls life. Yet we should always keep in mind that while we are crafting our myths, others are crafting theirs. And sometimes we are all connecting the same dots, but in different patterns. That does not mean we're wrong, but it does not mean we're exclusively right either. Because more important than relating fact or fiction is that everyone's personal sacred myth gives them life by helping them make sense of their experience in the world. As Gilman says, it's not a question of yes myth or no myth, but which myth. And that imperative to have a personal sacred myth makes myths more powerful than capital T truth or capital F fiction could ever be. So in this night of Kol Nidre, as we sit here as individuals examining how our lives are making sense, I'm wondering, what are the Jewish myths that over time have sustained our lives as a people? And are they continuing to make sense when it comes to our experience in the world? If we're looking for a good Jewish myth, why don't we start at the beginning with a comment by the great French medieval sage Rashi on the very first verse of the Torah. Why does the Torah commence with the account of creation, says Rashi? In order that God might give them the heritage of the nations. For should the peoples of the world say to Israel, you are robbers, because you took by force the lands of the seven nations of Canaan, Israel may reply to them, all the earth belongs to the Holy One, blessed be He. He created it and gave it to whom He pleased. Think about the significance of that comment for a moment. The world was created so that God could give the land of Canaan, also known as the land of Israel, to the people of Israel. What a powerful and empowering myth for a people who have consistently accomplished more than our numbers would ever suggest. And the powerful sense of purpose that myth gives to our people's experience in the world is unquestionable. Our holy books, the Torah and the Talmud, put sojourning to and living in the land front and center of its discourse. The rabbinic heavyweights, including Maimonides, Joseph Caro, and Isaac Luria, all made pilgrimage to or lived for a very long time in the land of Israel. At the end of the Passover Seder, we proclaim that next year we'll celebrate in Jerusalem, no matter how unlikely that claim is to fulfill. And even tonight, the two verses from the Torah used to invoke the feeling of forgiveness after the recitation of Kol Nidre are intimately related to the life Israel would eventually live in the land. Then in the last 140 years or so, this sacred myth was bequeathed to the modern movement of Zionism to establish and protect a Jewish home in our ancestral homeland, the land of Israel, also known as the land of Palestine. The sheer power of this myth can be seen in the fateful moment when the Zionist movement was offered an opportunity to colonize Uganda instead of Palestine. Even though he advocated for adopting the Uganda Plan, as it was called, Theodor Herzl stood up in front of a room of divided delegates and raised his right hand and repeated the words of the Psalms, "If I forget you, O Jerusalem, let my right hand wither." The plan was voted down, and eventually the Zionist movement succeeded in establishing the State of Israel in the land of Palestine in 1948, a political affirmation of a religious truth that burns in the heart of the Jewish people. As Yossi Klein Halevi, author of the New York Times bestseller Letters to My Palestinian Neighbor, writes, Israel exists because it never stopped existing, even if only in prayer. Israel was restored by the cumulative power of Jewish longing. So, our longing for Israel has given our people a powerful sense of purpose that has united us through the centuries. But I wonder, if we examine the real challenges of the State of Israel's complex political, religious, and social reality today, does the State of Israel still make sense for us today? Now, this is the part of the sermon where you might be going, uh-oh, what's he about to say about Israel? And I think that anxiety is part of the point. Our community, especially the larger American Jewish community, is so divided over Israel to the point that there are people who experience that longing, yet do question whether this project that is the State of Israel continues to make sense. And perhaps even more frightening than that is that there are people who have experienced that longing yet feel that the myth itself, the myth of our right to live as an independent nation in a land promised to us since the moment of creation, is no longer making any sense. That is to say, that for some people, the myth of our origin as a people is breaking. Yom Kippur is the time to admit when our myths, and consequently when our souls, feel like they are breaking. Because on this day, nothing is hidden from God's view. Our vulnerability is completely exposed. As the Machzor states after the Ishamnu confession, you know the mysteries of the universe, the deepest secrets of everyone alive. You probe our innermost depths. You examine our thoughts and feelings. Nothing escapes you. Nothing is secret from you. Our sacred myths, the personal and collective stories that help us make sense of life, are vulnerable to God's examination. And like many of us here know, waiting for the results of any critical exam can make us very anxious. But maybe, just maybe, there is a space we can co-create together in which we can lower that anxiety, in which we can cherish each other's vulnerability as we share our personal sacred myths, especially when it relates to Israel, plumbing the depths of those myths to see if they're breaking or dying or still making sense. And as we do so, let's remind ourselves of the wisdom of the two founding myths of our congregation I shared earlier, namely that since each of us connects the dots of our sacred myths differently, then the purpose of sharing our myths is not to convince one another of the truth, but to gain insight into how each other's souls craft their truth. Al regel achat, while standing on one foot, I can tell you that when it comes to my personal sacred Israel myth, Israel was part of my DNA before I even existed. Yes, a part of that is due to being born into the Jewish people, as Rashi's comment suggests. But a lot of that is based on my family's connection to the land. For my grandparents living in Israel in the 1950s, when they had to choose between the only time they had available to take a hot shower or the only time that the Israeli Philharmonic was playing, to my cousin Josh joining the IDF last year, living in the land, medabrim be'ivrit, speaking Hebrew, and feeling connected to Israel's story is embedded in my family's relationship with Israel. Then when I came of age and visited Israel as a teenager during his 50th celebration, only to return a few years later to live for a year with Nativ, USY's year-long Israel program, did my family's legacy turn into a personal love affair. After all, nothing beats an Israeli techno dance rave on a bus with 30 fellow teenagers, or having a public bus driver wish you and your friends Chag Sameach on Sukkot. These experiences, among many, many others, made it so that when I'm in Israel, my soul jumps for joy in a way that can best be described by the psalmist. Shir hamalo b'shuv Adonai et shivat Zion hayinu kecholmim, az yimale sechok pinu ulshonenu rina. This is a song that lifts us up, because God returned us to Zion, to Israel, like we could have only dreamt about. But now in being returned, we cannot hold back our laughter and songs of joy. And so, I chose the dots, I assigned the numbers, and I drew the lines that form the invisible connecting tissues of my soul's truth, that when it comes to our people's sacred Israel myth, the State of Israel is a dream come true. And yet, at the very same time as I was drawing the lines and forming the connective tissues of my Israel myth, I was beginning to become aware that there were others who drew different lines and were forming very different connective tissues. Because as I was starting to become aware of the myth I was crafting on Nativ, the Second Palestinian Intifada erupted. As I mentioned last year on this very night, that experience of being in Israel during the Second Intifada opened me to start paying attention to something bigger than myself. Eventually, that journey led me to become a rabbi, but in the interim, it led me down a very different path, one that nearly broke my burgeoning Israel myth beyond repair. After my experience on Nativ, I decided to pursue a major in the Middle East and Asian Languages and Cultures Department called MILAC at Columbia University. Now, even if you're not aware of the issues surrounding anti-Zionism on college campuses today, you may be interested to know that Columbia was one of, if not the most significant incubators of that rhetoric and activism. Not necessarily on the student level, but on the academic and scholarly level, because of the influential work of Columbia professor Edward Said's 1978 book, Orientalism. In this book, Said defines Orientalism as the Western style for dominating, restructuring, and having authority over the Orient, i.e. the East. Or to put it another way, the people of the East will be forced to believe whatever myths the West wants them to believe. And according to Said, since the primary project the West used to administer that domination was colonialism, then modern Zionism, a 19th century European movement to return Jews to their ancestral homeland in Palestine, a land without a people for a people without a land, as Herzl put it, was viewed as a result of that Orientalist colonialist doctrine. As Said, who was a Palestinian, wrote in The Question of Palestine, "To us, Zionism has meant as much, albeit differently, as it has to Jews. What we need to inform the world about is how it meant certain concrete things to us, things of which we collectively bear the living traces." I learned some of those concrete things during my time studying as a Milek major, and learning those things challenged my sacred myth about Israel in profound ways. It's when I first wondered if this whole Israel thing continued to make sense. I resisted as strongly as I could, shooting up my hand in the air during class to protest. But another part of me, the one that was curious and wanted to listen, felt sad, even a little betrayed, that my myth was not expansive enough to draw the lines to connect these new dots I was encountering. As Gilman would have told me, this is what happens when a myth breaks, because a broken myth is one that has been exposed as our subjective human construct. I wonder, whether it's about Israel, God, Torah, or any myth in your life related to your relationships, your beliefs, or your purpose, have you ever experienced a moment like that when your myth, your way of organizing the world, is breaking, and you realize that the dream you are so thankful for coming true turns out to be someone else's nightmare at the exact same time? I don't know about you, but for me, that felt painful. Yet, looking back on that time years later, I feel grateful for that painful experience, because like a muscle you're working out, the fibers of my sacred myth needed to be broken down so it could regrow stronger, to connect more dots and form more resilient connective tissues. It forced me to redraw the lines of my sacred Israel myth to connect the new dots and the old dots. In academic speak, it's a process called a second or will naivete, and it is one that can be applied to all kinds of myths we're struggling to redeem. In short, a second or will naivete requires a willingness to step back into the myth of old, to intentionally choose to be naive again in order to restore the myth's power, even though it is broken. See, no matter what challenges I faced, I knew deep in my soul that my original sacred Israel myth was a part of my DNA, or, as Rashi put it, existed since God created the world. I had faith that though it was breaking, it was still living and would never die, because every time I step foot in Israel, I can feel my soul just jump for joy. No academic critique, no matter how persuasive, could ever dissuade me from that truth. And thus faith in the reality of that experience tells me I can let go of a particular belief of how the dots should be connected, and that when I'm ready to draw my next picture, the most important dots will still be there. Examining our personal myths, whatever they may be, or examining our people's sacred Israel myth is not as much fun as just living in them. When we are living in our sacred myths, things just make sense. The world is ordered. But Yom Kippur teaches us that in order to keep our myths living, in order to keep ourselves living, we need to be willing to go through a process of examination. We need to take a step back from the pictures we've drawn to ask ourselves, am I missing any dots that need to be connected? This is not an easy process, and at times it can be painful. Yet there is a hopefulness embedded within, because as the Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks says, "Those who hope strive, those who are disillusioned accept." We cannot be disillusioned. We must be hopeful that our myths, even if they feel like they are breaking, can grow and expand. Yet in order to have that hope, we need leaders who have developed that hope through experiences they've worked through and feel they can share from solid ground, even if those experiences are a little painful and the ground still shakes at times. On Sunday, November 4th, our Israel Committee will be presenting a program called Roots of Peace, featuring a pair of speakers, an Orthodox Jewish settler who lives across the Green Line, and a Palestinian activist whose family took a major role in the first Palestinian Intifada in the 1980s. Their sacred origin myths are born out of the stories emanating from those disparate identities I just described. Yet through their work with Roots Jedor Shorashim, they developed what they call a painful hope, a shared myth born out of the painful process of breaking their sacred origin myths in order to expand the dots those myths can connect, to regrow their myths, and thus cultivate the hope that others can do the same. Those of us sitting here in this room may or may not be willing to go through this process of breaking our myths, and that's okay. But the call of Yom Kippur is for us to be willing to at least examine our myths, and that begins by being willing, l'ha'azin, to give ear, to listen to each other's myths, whether that's on November 4th or otherwise. Perhaps we'll hear something that will resonate with us, or perhaps we'll hear something that will challenge us. But we can enter this process with the faith that the most important dots for us to connect will still be there after our process of myth examination is over. The picture that results from that process may or may not look the same, but it will be more fleshed out, able to incorporate the beauty of other people's pictures as well. And as we do that, we should encourage ourselves to share our myths with others so they can flesh out their pictures as well. And if we do that together, then the collective, greater, bigger picture of our congregation will be a breathtaking collage that displays the stories that resonate within our souls, our myths that are greater than truth or fiction could ever be. And that's something that's worth jumping for joy. Shana Tova, Gemar Chatima Tova. May this be a sweet new year, and may we be inscribed in the book of life.